Hello everyone and welcome to 4Panel, your weekly guide to the weird and wild worlds of comic and manga and everything in between. Or at least it is when someone remembers to actually upload the episodes, Rob!
I have... There's been problems, okay? Just don't.
Anyway, I'm Andrew, and as you've heard, I'm joined by my regular co-host, Rob, and my other mostly regular co-host, Mick.
Ever since I started eating the bran flakes, I have been mostly regular. Hello.
Now, I see what you do. Deliberately trying to get yourself fired from the show before it starts.
No, I tried that before it started. But you weren't having it. Something about being too lazy to do an hour's monologue.
And I stand by that choice.
The editing will be easier.
Anyway, what have we got today?
Yep, so today I was thinking... That new Spider-Man movie's coming out fairly soon, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It is.
And the villain is going to be Mysterio, who's a bit of a weird guy when you think about it, isn't he?
He's got a golden ball for a head.
He's certainly made some interesting costume choices.
Really, you'd think a man who uses his knowledge of special effects to basically do magic and also wears a fishbowl would be the weirdest villain that Spider-Man's ever fought. But you'd be wrong.
Well, I mean, there's the tentacles involved in Venom and Carnage, which spring to mind, and tentacles are always weird.
And that, you're not even scratching the surface, Rob.
I haven't even mentioned Dr. Octopus.
Exactly.
To be fair, I don't want him scratching the surface with the tentacles.
Anyway, we're going to be talking about Spider-Man villains. What are some of the weirdest ones that have ever existed? Specifically... We're going to be playing Who's That Spider-Mon?
Oh, dear. Andrew, are you absolutely sure the rules say only you can fire us?
Yes, for this specific reason.
Show me the rules.
Oh no,
where's that napkin? I'm sure I wrote them down somewhere. Anyway, yeah, we are going to be playing the internet's favourite game. Well, I yell out the name of a random comic book character, and you've got to guess what their deal is.
Okay.
So, first up, we're going to start with an easy one. The Walrus.
He's got a big mustache.
Oh. I came across the Walrus in a Deadpool. Oh, what did he do?
He's got a big mustache and teeth.
Isn't he... Basically a big amorphous fat bloke with, as you say, a tash and tea.
Isn't that just like the mutant blob with a mustache?
Almost. The Walrus alter ego Hubert Carpenter, who first appeared in the Defenders issue 131, created by J.M. DeMatteis, Peter Gillis and Alan Kupperberg, has the proportionate speed, strength and agility of a walrus.
Hang on. When you say proportionate speed, strength and agility, is that inside and outside the water?
Because, let's be honest, no athletics commentator has ever used, in their commentary on the exploits of people like Usain Bolt or Mo Farah, said, and look at him going down the outside with the speed of a walrus.
He also has a protective layer of blubber to keep him warm.
They have said that about me.
Wow.
Good. I like that there's a very clear, like, law of diminishing returns to Spider-Man's animal villains. Because you've got, like, the rhino and the vulture and the chameleon. And then, like, Grizzly, who's a man in a bear costume, which I guess. And then the kangaroo.
Hang on. The what?
Yeah, the kangaroo.
Is this just some skinny guy with boxing gloves who jumps around a lot?
Well, no, there's actually been...
You do know that kangaroos don't wear boxing gloves in the wild.
I know that. I'm saying this is comic books, so obviously, in order to portray the whole boxing kangaroo thing, they'd put boxing gloves on it.
Well, he don't call himself the boxing kangaroo, does he? Just the kangaroo. I mean, you're just being ridiculous now.
Exactly. I'll have you know, he's a man who wears a robotic kangaroo suit and does really big kicks.
So Mick, do you want to go back to my boxing gloves on a kangaroo idea again and say how ridiculous it was?
Yeah, I think you've just not got a good idea of what the baseline for normal is in this conversation, do you?
I think I do, and I think it's in our tagline of because comics.
It's also ironic, because if you think about the vulture, vultures are nothing. They just sort of hang about waiting for things to die and then peck at them. Kangaroos, though, they'll have your head off.
Yeah. I've just remembered one Spider-Man villain from years ago, and I don't know if this was on your list or not. I'm hoping it is.
Possibly. It better not be my favourite weird Well, not my favourite. I feel like my favourite weird Spider-Man villain is Swarm, the Nazi made of bees, but we have mentioned him many a time.
Yeah, he was in Squirrel Girl. We've talked about him before. No, not him. Because, you know, DC has The Question.
Oh, you're talking about The Spot.
No, not The Spot.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I know who you mean. We're getting... Well, no, you know, let's jump straight to him. Rob, tell me about The Answer.
I just remember the name and the fact that he had, like, a purple costume with, like, some weird kind of purple costume with an exclamation mark on it, if I remember rightly. But he was just... I don't remember much about him, just that he was called The Answer and he was a Spider-Man villain.
Yeah, he is. I think you both might want to Google him just because he has got some interesting costume choices.
Really? Is this safe for work Googling that we're doing here?
It's no. It's safe for work. It's just, it's like a purple hooded...
Yeah.
I want to say onesie, but I don't know if it's a onesie because he also has a...
That's him. That's the answer. He's got like those flaps under his arms.
Yeah, he's just like... It's like he's wearing like baggy MC Hammer trousers, but on his arms. I guess because he's worried they would obscure the gigantic gold codpiece.
Yes.
That's it. This is the answer.
Isn't he a luchador that's escaped from somewhere?
A luchador, yeah.
Who even knows? But yeah, this is a man named Aaron Nicholson, first appeared in Peter Parker, The Spectacular Spider-Man, issue 91, created by Al Milgram. And he has the most ridiculous powers, because his powers, and I quote, the answer to whatever he needs at the time.
What?
Basically, if he comes up on a problem, he has powers that will resolve that situation.
Isn't that the most convenient superpower of all?
How does he ever lose anything?
And I'm sorry, but if his superpower is that, they missed out on the best name ever, called him Deus Ex.
I mean, I would have just gone for Aspel.
Isn't that basically the... Hasn't he basically got the powers of Lucky Man, the Stan Lee TV show?
Yes, he is James Nesbitt.
Are you saying The Answer had a TV show?
He has the proportionate strength, speed and agility of James Nesbitt.
Are you saying The Answer had a TV show and nobody knew about it?
Yep.
My mind is blown.
See, I feel like I'm skimming through this kind of entry on the Marvel Wiki. And basically how stories with The Answer work is... Everything goes fine for him until suddenly they don't.
Okay.
Anyway, shall we move on to one of Spider-Man's deadliest foes?
Go on then.
Yes.
Guys, tell me, who is Slide?
Slide? How many eyes has that got in it?
Precisely zero.
And is this Slide spelled with a Y?
Yep. Slyde.
Was this a character from the 90s, which is why they spelled Slide with a Y?
No, actually, he is from Amazing Spider-Man issue 272 from 1986.
Is he a skateboarder at all?
No, Rob, that's ridiculous. Come on, this is a character created by comics legends Tom DeFalco and Sal Buscema. Of course he's not a skateboarder.
He might be, with a name like Slide.
Is he a snowboarder?
No. If anything, that's even further away.
Is he...
Hang on. Is he one of those Turkish oil wrestlers?
Is he a moonwalker?
Oh, you're both getting close. You're both getting dangerously close.
What? He's a moonwalking Turkish oil wrestler.
Yes, because this is Slide, a.k.a. the Teflon-coated man. He wears a costume made out of a special non-stick coating that allows him to just slip away from anything. So how can you catch a thief when you can't grab him? Because he just slips out your grip and then slips on down the street.
Sorry. My mind is kind of rebelling against this.
Me too.
I know, he's great because he just comes in and robs a bank and then escapes by doing that ridiculous Looney Tune running while he just slips down the street.
See, I've just got, you know when you get like an ice patch or a muddy, like really waterlogged field and basically people slide on their bellies across it? I just got an image of Slide doing that and escaping from everybody. Just sliding down the street like that.
I mean, yeah, that's literally what his superpower is. How does he ever take his costume off?
That's a point. That costume's not very... Oh, no. My brain went there. Damn you, Andrew. My brain went there.
Maybe when he needs to get his costume off, he has to team up with the answer.
Or Paste Pot Pete. With a special glue gun. Also, I've just found an even better part. The chemicals on Slide's suit allow him to move at nearly 30 miles an hour. So not only is he just slipping and sliding, he's slipping and sliding at, like, the speed of a car.
Going through 30 miles an hour.
Oh. Just imagine if he trips. I love Slide. I'm also worried now that we've maybe peaked too early.
I don't know. I can think it's bringing back memories of some others. Wasn't there a guy? I remember seeing a picture of a guy sitting on top of a coconut tree.
I think you might be thinking of Plant Man.
Was that Plant Man? He was chucking coconuts at Spider-Man. I know that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Plant Man used his mutant mastery over all plant life one time.
It was basically Marvel's Poison Ivy.
Yeah. I mean, Poison Ivy, if she had a lovely pair of coconuts.
Oh, was this from like 1980s or 1970s Spider-Man? It must have been.
Almost definitely, because when we got to 90s Spider-Man, we got such creative villains as Bloodshed, Slaymaster, probably some other one, Hitmaker.
Hang on. Bloodshed, Slaymaster, and Hitmaker. That's
stock aching and one.
I was about to say that.
Also, I'm confused.
What?
Because surely Hitmaker, that's not like the person who carries out assassinations, is it?
No, you'd think.
If anything, his job is to just kind of fill out the form.
He's like an agent.
Yeah, basically.
More of a facilitator than an actual assassin.
Yes.
If anything, what he does is he approaches his targets and helps them have a very successful music career.
Never know. Maybe that's what some people want. Maybe that's what some supervillains want. They just want to be idols.
He also has giant shoulder pads, and on like the right-hand one, it has a giant H, and on the left-hand one, it has a giant M.
Hey, during some eras of humanity, that was fashion. And he must have been from the 80s, because the giant shoulder pads are definitely 80s.
Are you saying that this supervillain was basically the Madness logo?
Yes, he was.
But there can't be any supervillains who've used letters as weapons, surely.
No, I can't think of anything like that.
Really? You're not aware of Golden some... Typeface Thomas?
I was leading up to it. Yeah.
I'm not aware of this one.
Oh, this is brilliant, this one.
Yeah, Typeface basically runs around with a bunch of letters hanging off of him, and he can throw them.
Hang on. What? Just back up a couple of steps there. So, are you saying Typeface is... He's like a very verbose Bullseye?
He's more like Captain Boomerang, but less exciting.
Yeah. Also, surely he has got to have, like, wildly varying rates of success depending on what letter he uses.
Yeah.
Either that or he spent far too long playing Typing of the Dead.
Put it this way, if he appeared on an episode of Countdown, there'd be carnage.
Well, Venom's son would be on there as well.
Well, yeah, he'd have to have an opponent. Well, I suppose it'd have to be Otto Octavius, because the aim is to become an Octo-champ.
Oh, hang on, is Typeface's arch-nemesis Comic Sans? Please it is.
Actually, I'm pretty sure his arch-nemesis is Venom, who killed him. Because turns out being a man who throws letters fighting an alien tentacle monster doesn't help all that much.
Yeah. Oh, that's a shame.
Also, do you know what I really appreciate about Typeface?
What?
Is that he has letters tattooed on his face. I like a nice literal villain.
You can't beat a good literal villain.
Speaking of, can we talk about Big Wheel?
Hang on, yes. Big Wheel was like, it was just a wheel, wasn't it?
Yeah. Big Wheel is a man named Jackson Wheel. Who drives a big wheel. It's a giant wheel with arms and like laser guns attached to it. And his main enemy is the Rocket Racer.
What I like is a man with a wheel that's got arms and lasers and he's massive, then joins a group called Villains Anonymous.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to rock up and say, oh yeah, hi, it's me, maybe I'm the Green Goblin. Maybe I'm Dr. Octopus. Who knows? Incidentally, while we're talking about weird Spider-Man villains, do you know that the Green Goblin originally had like a rocket-powered broomstick that he flew around on?
A what?
Yeah, in his first appearance, he flew on a rocket-powered broomstick.
Why?
I mean, we're also talking about a man who is a millionaire who decides he wants to put on like a green Halloween costume and hurl exploding pumpkins at people.
Yeah, but a rocket-powered broomstick. He's a guy. It's a broomstick. Unless you fit proper seating, it's going to be extremely uncomfortable.
Maybe that's what made him so crazy.
He gave himself too much of a front wedgie.
Yeah, it's you know, it's that famous scene, you know, just after the death of Gwen Stacy, where Green Goblin and the Spider-Man, they're fighting, and Spider-Man's really emotional. He's yelling about, how could you? I'd loved her, Norman. How could you kill her? And then Norman tries to impale Spider-Man with his glider, and Spider-Man dodges, and Norman gets impaled instead. And just at the last moment, you finally kind of see the madness clear from his eyes as he turns to Peter and says, it's over. The chafing's finally over. It's a real watershed moment in comics.
Oh. So what else have we got in this list of bizarre Spider-Man villains?
What else have we got? Let's see who people think are how dare you list I'm looking at? How dare you put the Spot on a list of weird Spider-Man? Spot is the best Spider-Man villain.
Isn't Spot the one who can basically have, like, stuff come out of the spots on his body?
Yeah, he can basically do weird teleporting stuff.
Basically a teenager.
Oh, no, he is. I've got a good one. Can you tell me about the Hypno-Hustler?
The Hypno-Hustler. Okay, this
wasn't
is
that a song by the McCoys back in about 1974?
I was going to say this has to be something from the 70s.
Oh, it is very. So this is 1978.
Oh, please say this is disco. Something to do with disco.
Well, if I tell you, he shows up with a team called the Mercy Killers backing him up.
Oh my God. There's got to be disco involved in this. Please say disco.
He has a special guitar that can hypnotize people. He's a disco man who uses his funky, funky music to hypnotize the masses.
Oh, my God.
Oh, he can also spray knockout gas from his boots.
And why not?
They're platforms, aren't they? They're platform boots. They have to be.
I'm pretty sure. I don't think I've ever made it all the way down to Hypno Hustler's feet because he's got a lot going on.
I thought you were going to say because he was drawn by Rob Liefeld.
You never know. Oh, who's that one?
No, he's got the massive boots and the weird swirly eye goggles and the giant microphone necklace. Yep, what looked like big platform boots. Oh, hypno hustler. Anyway, Rob, what have you got for us?
I was going to ask, wasn't there one, a Spider-Man villain who was just so bad, even Spider-Man felt guilty about beating him up? I'm trying to remember his name, because he found some rock and it sprayed him with a gas. And he kept trying to pick a fight with Spider-Man, and Spider-Man kept beating him and really feeling guilty about beating an idiot.
This Meteor Man?
No, it was a much lamer name than that. It was,
I mean, we've just talked about someone called the Hypno Hustler, Rob.
We also talked about Typeface, who had no discernible superpowers.
The Looter.
Oh, wait, no. This is the same character.
Is it?
Yeah, the Looter, also known as Meteor Man.
Oh, is it Meteor Man? I thought Meteor Man was that guy from that movie.
I mean, I don't know if you've heard, Rob, in quite a few movies.
Yeah, there was a movie called Meteor Man, though. But that.
Yes, I'm. You know, there was also a movie called Spider-Man.
Yes, there was. And then never the twain shall meet. But anyway, tell us about the Looter.
I have a shocking confession to make.
What?
I've no idea who this is.
And on that bombshell, the four-panel showrunner was fired.
Oh no, that is the loophole. If we ever find a comic book character who I don't know, I have to return to my kingdom under the mountains.
It's the way to drive him back. We finally found it, Mick.
We knew it would happen one day. We found his Achilles heel.
Yeah, all I remember about him was that Spider-Man kept feeling guilty about beating him. And he's been around for, like, ages.
His name is Norton G. Fester.
Oh, why wouldn't it be?
I have found what might be one of, or possibly just some of my favourite lines in a Wikipedia article. After attempting to steal another meteor to continually supply himself with his powers, he was defeated by Spider-Man after a battle in a hot air balloon. Since then, the Looter has had no success whatsoever, even after a name change to Meteor.
Even rebranding couldn't save him.
Oh no, he is the patron saint of Four Panel.
So does he actually have powers or not? Because I don't remember him having powers.
Well, according to this, exposure to meteor gas grants him superhuman strength and agility, a high degree of durability, and extraordinary leaping.
As opposed to that normal leaping,
well,
which other people find so mundane.
Hang on. You mentioned leaping. You're going there, aren't you?
We're going there, aren't we?
You know you have to. You mentioned the word leaping.
We have to talk about Leapfrog.
Yes, you do. You got to talk about Eugene.
But I think you'll find I could talk about Eugene or Vincent.
Oh, yes.
Both of whom decided that they were going to not only become villains and then heroes who dress up like a big frog. And love the idea that says that they have a frog suit exoskeleton that grants them the ability to leap great distances. It's a cartoon frog costume with springs on the feet.
It's basically Spring-Heeled Jack for modern times.
Yes. And also a frog. But depending on how he's drawn, he can also be a frog who's got like a giant cartoon frog head. And you can just see like his eyes coming out the mouth. I think we've done it. We've reached the worst Spider-Man villain.
Really? Because I'm looking at some of these villains, and they're quite high resolution compared to one.
Are you on about Video Game Man?
No.
Video Man.
Video Man doesn't count.
Why does Video Man not count?
Because he's from the Spider-Man and the Amazing Friends cartoon.
And he also appeared in an issue of the comics. So he does count.
Oh. It's also really weird because in that I think he's a mutant.
What?
So he's like, he's also an X-Men enemy.
How is he a mutant?
Can you just about... Come on, X-Men. All our greatest enemies are united. Magneto. Apocalypse, Mr. Sinister, Video Man. Yeah, I think he's just a man who was made into evil electricity.
Wasn't the one who was, like, Modular Man or something like that?
What, you bought him from IKEA?
Well, no, that would be Flatpak Man.
Oh, my God, yeah, the Modular. I think he was, like, might even have been a Bloodstone enemy. But Ulysses Bloodstone, he was immortal, shot monsters with his big gun.
Yeah, because Elsa Bloodstone's his daughter.
Yeah, I was going to say, had a daughter who was way better than him.
Yeah.
Modular Man. Modular Man. Why are you called Modular Man, Modular Man? Because you seem to be some kind of weird electric skeleton.
Maybe his weird electric skeleton was something that he built up over 52 weekly issues. The first issue available for the bargain price of £1.99. Subsequent volumes cost £17.
Well, apparently he can detach and reassemble his body. Like some kind of QVC kitchenware appliance.
It does sound like an incredibly useful skill.
It's just, you need a whisk, just take off your hand, replace it with a whisk.
Yeah. Hang on, wasn't that the bad guy from Enter the Dragon?
Yes.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure at one point he did just have like a spatula hand. That's right, and then he fought Bruce Lee with his hand made up of an entire set of luxury steak knives, yours for only $49.99 if you call now.
What about the Fusser brothers? What can you tell us about those?
Who?
The Fusser brothers.
And the what now?
Hubert and Pinky Fusser.
How are you spelling Fusser?
Exactly how you'd expect. F-U-S-S-E-R. First names, Hubert and Pinky.
Fusion.
You thought I was making it up, didn't you?
I did. I did for a sec.
I'm reading the page. Spider-Man's most WTF villains. Kangaroo didn't have a kangaroo outfit.
Oh, no, that's the other kangaroo. It was just some dude.
just some dude who looks like Oliver Reed crossed with the Hulk.
I don't know if he could even do kicks. I think he was just big and strong.
Yeah. Spider-Side is listed.
Yeah, but if we talk about Spider-Side, then I have to talk about the Clone Saga, and that's...
That's going to hurt your head.
It is going to hurt my head. It's just going to make everyone sad and confused.
What about Swarm? Is Swarm going to be mentioned?
Oh, no, well, like I said earlier, Swarm is one we've already mentioned quite a few times.
Okay. Mindworm?
Mindworm, nah.
Yeah.
He's just got a big head.
And a tragic story.
Oh, who among us hasn't been beaten to death by a gang of thugs?
True, I guess. We don't want to run the risk of starting a new sort of Me Too campaign, do we?
Yeah, exactly. Although I bet we could get hashtag justice for Mindworm trending on Twitter.
Mindworm's terrible revenge.
Mindworm's what now?
Terrible revenge.
Oh, it's like revenge, but spelt like how it's spelt.
Yeah, it's a reference to a Blackadder episode where Hugh Laurie plays a German spy. I will wreak a most terrible revenge.
Not Blackadder the Third.
No, Blackadder the Second.
Wait.
He then comes and kills...
That's right, he kills everyone, and that's how the series ends, isn't it?
No, he kills... Yes, he kills everybody because he turns up dressed as the cow.
Yeah, and then that's why he's Prince George in the next one.
Yeah.
Now I remember. Anyway, Fusion. That's who you're talking about, Mick.
That's right. That's who the Fusser brothers were.
Yep, Herbert and Pinky. One a nuclear scientist, one a janitor.
Then I wonder which one was which.
Well, we know one of them was the brain.
Hey!
I see what you did. Is that like some kind of predestination thing? Where just as parents you go, right, we want this one to go up successful, so he's Hubert, and this one going to be Pinky. Anyway, they got merged into one weird glowing man with two heads because of science reasons. So I'd love this powers and abilities page. It's powers, superhuman strength, emits radiation, weaknesses. Hubert and Pinky did not agree with each other. I mean, I think that's where we take a break.
There are no words.
Yes.
I'm glad we all agree with each other at least.
Yeah.
Hello, do you like films? Well, wow, that's good. We're over the first hurdle. If you like films, and you also like podcasts, you should probably check out the Geek Show's only dedicated movie podcast, Cinema Eclectica. Well-staffed with a trained array of helper monkeys, we review all of the latest films every week, and do it reasonably well.
Hi, and welcome back to 4Panel, and now the important bit of the show where we tell you about things what we've been reading.
With our eyes and stuff.
Yeah. And in Rob's case, his index finger.
The middle one is quite prominently pointed in your direction, Mick, whichever direction that is.
Hey, to be fair, I didn't mention that your lips move as well.
Anyway. I've got, first up, Dragon Age Deception. Now, I've covered a couple of Dragon Age graphic novels before, and they've generally been kind of enjoyable. But I've got to say, this one, and there is an ongoing narrative in the Dragon Age graphic novels, which I do like, and this one continues on with this loose overarching narrative that ties in with the end events and the plot of the Dragon Age games. And this one focuses on a new character called Olivia Pride, who hasn't really worked an honest day in years. She's a former actress, but now lives as a con artist. And she's gone to the Winterlands with a new target. And she quickly realizes that things aren't going exactly to plan, because there is another con artist in the area, and the two of them are kind of getting in each other's way. And then throw into that the fact that a former target of her cons from Ferelden is now in Tevinter, and she has seen him, and he's still kind of enamored with her as well. I know I'm throwing out loads of terms and phrases and stuff like that, but this is clear. This is very much aimed at people who've played and, above all, enjoyed the Dragon Age games, people who really bought into the narrative for the Dragon Age games, bought into the storyline. And I've got to say, I like this. The artwork's good. It's by Fernando Heinz Furukawa, and the actual story is by Nunzio De Filippis and Christina Weir. Colours are by Michael Attier, and letters by Nate Picos of Blambot, wherever that might be. And I've got to say,
just outside Sheffield, I think.
Possibly. The actual dialogue in this is really good. It's got some really interesting and witty banter between some of the characters, especially the con artists, and the characters have known each other for a while. They actually have some interesting asides and conversations as well. It is exactly what you'd expect from a Dragon Age story. There is blood at some point. There is magic. There are explosions and fights and stuff like that. It's got some character sketches at the back as well. It's a nice little addition to the world of Dragon Age. In the same way that they've done with Mass Effect, they're really building on the actual games in the Dragon Age series with these graphic novels, and I like what they're doing with them. The artwork really is interesting, though. And I think that's one of the high points of this, is just the costuming, the design, everything like that.
I think one of the great things with both Mass Effect and Dragon Age is that the world building that they did in the games is so rich and so detailed that having the graphic novels, and I know there's constantly been rumours of film versions. There's so many gaps you can fill in the storylines, but there's so much detail that there's plenty to... It, almost like the Star Wars universe has got all those offshoot novels and TV shows.
Yeah,
there's plenty of room in there to do that without it contradicting anything that goes in the games.
Yeah, definitely.
That is one of the things I love about the Dragon Age and the Mass Effect games in particular. I also like that about the old Knights of the Old Republic games that were on the Xbox and the PC as well, because they did some really good world building in there as well to do with Star Wars. But that was BioWare's deal. It's impressive that they actually made games that can support external stories like these.
Okay, but what if instead of doing that, they just made a generic Destiny clone?
Well, in that case, we despise them and all that they stood for.
What if we despised EA and everything they stood for instead?
I've been doing that ever since what they did to Mass Effect.
You monsters. You took something beautiful and you killed it.
And then you gave us Anthem and asked us to buy it.
What they didn't tell you was that they were giving you basically a dead body.
Which you could reanimate using microtransactions.
Exactly.
Yeah, but see, pay us £5 and we'll send a blast of electricity through the body to make it spasm a bit. That's what Anthem is.
Yes.
I'm going to sit in my sad hole now.
Who's taking over from me now, then?
Oh, was that the end?
Yeah, I was done ages ago.
Yeah. We were just wallowing in our own self-pity.
Remembering what was and what could have been.
Well, speaking of wallowing in your own self-pity, I may as well go next then. Because I've been reading Mob Psycho 100 by One.
That's not wallowing in your own self-pity.
Close enough.
To be fair, the cover I saw on that issue, it looked like the character was wallowing in their own self-pity.
Yeah, but you thought the character was Ringo.
I'm fairly convinced that over 4 volumes, you're going to get the complete set. And that it's all going to turn out to just be a manga adaptation of the Yellow Submarine movie.
It's actually a prequel to a Spider-Man comic. Because the thing about Mob Psycho 100 is he is the walrus.
Yes, he is.
Oh, dear.
Hey, I made a thematically appropriate joke.
Mm.
So this series follows a character named... Oh, no, I forgot what his actual name is.
Isn't it Shigeki?
Shigeo. Yeah, Shigeo, that's
sorry.
Name. Also known as Mob for his uncanny ability to just blend into the background of any scene. He is, yeah, fairly typical high school teen. He's quite clueless. When I say typical, he's more kind of very withdrawn, very socially awkward. And that's because he struggles to display any kind of emotion at all without his triggering his vast psychic powers.
Wow.
And this just follows his adventures as he tries to deal with school life and also exercise ghosts as part of his part-time job with Reagan Arataka, rising star of the 21st century.
And also one of the best characters to grace anime and manga.
Yes.
Ever.
It's great. Because he is Mob Sensei and teacher in all matters of psychic abilities. He's also 100% a fraud.
Yep. And the thing is, Mob knows that he's a fraud, but he's kind of Mob's spiritual anchor. He basically grounds Mob into reality and keeps him grounded.
Well, I like the fact that despite, you know, being like kind of a scummy psychic, he's like the only person who treats Mob like he's a human being.
Yeah.
And like genuinely tries to help him control his psychic powers.
Yeah. He actually genuinely cares about what happens to Mob, and that's it's just this weird, you know what I mean, you've read it, you've watched it.
Yeah, exactly. It's this really weird but kinda nice dynamic. So these two volumes, they mostly just follow Mob's kind of everyday adventures. The first kind of big school arc is him trying to get recruited into the Telepathy Club, who are basically an after-school club theoretically designed to test normal people's psychic powers, but is mainly just an excuse for a bunch of lazy kids to hang around eating snacks all day. And it ends with him looking like he's about to join the Telepathy Club, only suddenly swerve left and go into Body Improvement Club instead. Because if there's one thing Shigeo cares about more than anything, more than understanding the secret behind his gifts, more than defeating like the myriad evil spirits who want to eat his soul, it's getting a rocking bod so that he can impress the ladies.
Yep, he's got his priorities straight.
Yeah, I loved. See, that's the kind of thing that makes this series great, is it's kind of, it's a dumb, goofy joke, but it does also have this undercurrent of, he just wants to do something that's going to make him feel like a normal person.
Yeah.
And yet, like, as much as I love Mob Psycho 100, it's kind of a bit hard to recommend volumes 1 and 2, because I feel like this is a series that started as a webcomic, so the art style is very rough. Like, lots of people whose proportions are weird. And it's just, it's basically scene for scene exactly adapted into the anime as well. It's kind of hard to say, oh yeah, you should read this, when, to be honest, there's just a much better version that you can watch instead.
This is true. This is true. Yeah.
It's also, the problem is, volume 2 ends basically right before the point when the series gets really good, because it is when Mob has to confront another psychic teen known as Teru, who basically is going off on all this stuff about, you know, he is God's gift to mankind. He is the most perfect boy. I am the protagonist of the world. Everyone should follow what I do, because I'm the best. And Mob's response is, no, you're not that impressive. I mean, if the only way you can be special is to rely on, like, these psychic powers you have, that's not that impressive. You're just like someone who can run fast or is good at maths or whatever. You're no better than them. And I think that's when it kind of starts to get into, like, the central theme of the series, of this idea of kind of not allowing a gift you have to make you complacent. It's like, it's more important, like, to grow as a person and to just be good to your friends and have a normal, healthy life. And it kind of, that's the point where this ends. So really, a lot of this stuff is just kind of fun, mostly sort of gag humor.
Okay.
But it's still, yeah, if for whatever reason you'd rather read this than watching the anime, yeah, go for it. It's very good. It's just weird to recommend it when there's a much better version available.
Yeah, that's fair enough. That is fair enough. So Mick's turn then.
Yes, and I am kicking off with Edgar Rice Burroughs, The Once and Future Tarzan, which...
That's not really that impressive, though, is it?
What?
I mean, he's always going to be the once and future Tarzan, isn't he? Like, I'm the once and future Andrew.
Not if you carry on interrupting me, you won't be.
It's the loving environment that I'm glad we worked on. Think of what makes it so popular.
So this is a reimagining of Edgar Rice Burroughs' classic Ape Man, and it comes from Dark Horse Comics. It's by Alan Gordon, with art by Thomas Yates and Bo Hampton. And it's a bit of an odd fish. It's the first time I've come across a post-apocalyptic Tarzan story.
A what?
Yeah, that's right. You heard me. A post-apocalyptic Tarzan story.
Okay.
That's a really, really sharp left turn.
I know. And that's before we set off.
And hang on. It's Tarzan. He swings through the trees. It's post-apocalyptic.
No, he lives in London.
This needs more explaining.
He lives in London. Fortunately, London is a jungle full of trees. Post-apocalyptic. I mentioned that, right?
Hang on. So how are the trees?
Because it's post-apocalyptic. The forest has taken back the city. The city, Big Ben's on its side. The River Thames is actually more like the canals of Venice.
Yeah,
There's crocodiles in the Serpentine.
All right, okay.
Yeah, giraffes are walking across the place. It's the last of us, Ellie. Bow, bow, wow, wow.
Just for those of our listeners who may not be so familiar with Tarzan, remind me who Tarzan is.
He's like George of the Jungle, but old.
So old. So basically he's Lord Greystoke, whose family were out exploring Africa and were sadly killed. He was raised by animals in the jungle and became Lord of the Jungle. He's athletic like an ape, can hunt, can track, etc. But his destiny is to discover his origins and actually reconnect with his Greystoke heritage in San Francisco and then London. That is the traditional Tarzan that we know and love, and probably the most accurate retelling of that was in the Christopher Lambert film.
Yeah.
In about 1986.
The one that was literally called Greystoke, the Greystoke, Legend of Tarzan.
The Legend of Tarzan. So, what we've got here is a very different Tarzan to the one that I remember. Because I grew up watching Ron Eli on TV and reruns of the Johnny Weissmuller films, which were all very much set in the jungle. In this, there seems to be a sort of, almost like a Lazarus Pit element, because our story picks up, this is the same Tarzan that we watched in 1930s black and white serials. In fact, they've replicated the chapter format of those Republican serials that you used to get of like Tarzan and Flash Gordon and all those things. The art style is like the old school Boyzone comics that you used to get with those kind of adventure heroes in. But they've put this sort of Lazarus Pit type thing. There's mention of some tablets, that pills that are made out of some ancient voodoo substance type thing. Tarzan in here is 300 years old.
What?
Sure, why not?
So it is, although it's a post-apocalyptic, and I don't think they actually mention a date, but it's something like the 23rd century. And yeah, so he's got collections of animals that he's conserving in archives across London. Jane is equally as old as he is. She's less comfortable with the idea.
It seems weird that you do that and not just, like, reimagine the story of Tarzan, but in a post-apocalyptic setting.
Yeah. I mean, this is a continuation rather than a reboot or a reimagining as we would normally expect. The story is solid. The storytelling is solid. There's a little bit of history with a cabal that have been trying to hunt Tarzan down and understand his secret of longevity. He meets up with an all-female tribe who follow him as a leader after they earn his trust, because originally they mistrust him because he's a man. There's merfolk. It covers a lot of different realms that you're not used to seeing in Tarzan necessarily. But it doesn't feel out of place in the rest of the mythos, even though it's got all these elements that are completely unrecognisable. And it does kind of sort of have little nods to other sort of late 19th century literature. There's a submarine trip, and the submarine design owes more than a little inspiration to the Nautilus from 20,000 Leagues. And it's, but it's beautifully drawn. The story's fast-paced. It's broken down into those chapters, as I said. And if you've never read any Tarzan, it's worth a read. If you have read Tarzan, it's still worth a read, because it's a different Tarzan, but causally familiar.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
I shall have to have a read.
Well, you'll have to prize it from my cold dead hands first.
Let you two fight it out, because I'm not that fussed about Tarzan.
For me, though, I do have something that I am fussed about. You guys both turned this down. You actually turned down something quite interesting.
Well, in our defence, I think we turned it down because its marketing team failed to make it sound interesting.
In my defence, I'd forgotten what you're talking about.
Witch Hat. I'm talking about Witch Hat to Tell You by Kamome Shirahama, which is out from Kodansha, and this is volume one of Witch Hat to Tell You. And it's an interesting idea. It's an interesting concept. And I'm going to have to bring up Harry Potter here, and also Little Witch Academia as well, as much as I hate to bring those two things up at the same time. But I've got to, because they both play a part in Witch Hat to Tell You. Not literally, but by extension. Little Witch Academia, anime fans will know, they're familiar with that from Studio Trigger, the OVA and the series, and everyone went nuts about it.
Ah, well, there you go. I couldn't have read it, because As I've said many times before, I've never seen an anime in my life, and I refuse to ever to.
Even Mob Psycho, which you've just talked about?
Nope, never seen it.
Anyway.
Yeah, I don't know why this is the lie I've decided on. This very easily disprovable lie.
As I was saying, people will automatically liken this to Harry Potter and to Little Witch Academia. I think it bears more resemblance to an older show, an older anime series called Tweeny Witches, than it does to Little Witch Academia. Although the main character in this, Coco, is very much like the main character from Little Witch Academia. There are shades of Harry Potter in this as well, with the wizard school and the apprentices and the wands and everything like that. There are elements with the magical world being slightly separate, but kind of part of the real world as well. But that's where the similarities end. What you have, Komami Shirahama has done some very, very nice artwork for this manga. The characters are really well designed. The scenery, the backgrounds, there's loads of little details in this. It's such a nice, enjoyable read. When the panels need to be blank, they are suitably blank, but when they need lots of detail, there's lots of detail to be found. The characters are all individually unique. There's none of that fluffing that you see in a lot of manga and comics where they use the same facial structure for multiple characters. You know, they'll just basically change the wig or put on glasses.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? The story is basically about a young girl called Coco who lives with her mom. And there's just her and her mom, and they live in a village, and they're separated from the world of magic. And in this world, magic is basically the realm of people who were born with magic. And so witches are a thing in this world, and witches are basically, they're seen as these benign beings who basically produce things that make the world a better place for the people who live in it, for the normal people. Coco has been fascinated by magic for years, and so any chance she gets to witness magic, she will take. Unfortunately, Coco was also chosen by somebody for a certain purpose, and that this doesn't go into detail as to who that is. It does give you some hints that there are darker forces stirring than anybody realizes. But suffice to say, a horrible, horrible accident occurs, and Coco ends up being taken under the wing of a witch who has decided that they're going to train Coco in magic in order to try and undo the horrible mistake that has been made. And that's when it kind of deviated from the whole Harry Potter thing and from Little Witch Academia. You've got the main character starting off having made a horrible, horrible mistake and having already kind of paid a price for the usage of magic. And that's where it started moving into the realms of manga like Nagima. I will say, this manga actually did cause a hell of a fuss in Japan. It became extremely popular very, very quickly. It was the talk of the town for a while. The ardour has cooled off a little bit, but hopefully it will regain some of that popularity now that it's being released here in the UK. I definitely recommend this. It's very, very good. It's very well worth a read.
Yeah, cool. What else is worth a read?
What?
Beasts of Burden, Wise Dogs and Eldritch Men.
I told you it was worth a read.
I mean, I feel like this is not the one you needed to convince me on.
I know. Having read Beasts of Burden before, I just need to, like, hand you the book and you went, oh, I'm going to read it.
Not even hand me, just, like, place the book within my general vicinity.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is by Evan Dorkin, Benjamin Dewey and Nate Picos.
And this is the same Evan Dorkin who wrote Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah, that's one of those things we always need to take a second to just go, what?
Yeah, but not just Call of Cthulhu. There was that one I reviewed a few weeks back as well.
Was it Blackwood or something like that?
Blackwood, yeah.
Which was kind of in between Beasts of Burden and Call of Cthulhu, wasn't it?
No, it was definitely more in line with Call of Cthulhu.
I said kind of in between. I wouldn't say it was like right in the middle.
Yeah, no, it was adjacent to Call of Cthulhu.
Okay.
Basically, Evan Dorkin is a really inconsistent writer, and it's kind of weird.
Except when it comes to writing about dogs who do magic.
Yeah, but I mean, but if you can write stuff that's this good, so this is kind of a spin-off from the main Beasts of Burden. This one doesn't actually follow the dogs of Burden Hill.
Yeah.
It's about the wise dogs, kind of the group of mysterious traveling puppies who just roll into town and resolve magical problems and roll back out again. So this starts with Lundy, who is a Highland Terrier, basically helping to stop a forest fire because it turns out it's a salamander causing it. A kind of mythical fire-breathing guy, not the tiny normal lizard kind. Anyway, he meets up with the rest of the group and they continue on their main adventure, which is to go to a farm called Darrington, where there's been reports of some monsters lurking about, and help kind of exorcise the place. But on their way, they get embroiled with a big old plot, which involves kind of mystical bear traps and enslaved troll monsters and a doomsday cult living in the Pocono Mountains. As per usual, it's great. It's basically kind of like Hellblazer.
Yeah.
But with dogs instead of snarky Liverpudlians.
When I first read Beats of Burden, I was singing its praises, and then you read it, and you were singing its praises, and it's still just as good, isn't it?
It is, because they're all such good dogs. Because there's Lundy, and Emmy is, who's a big, grey, shaggy dog, and Miranda, who's like the young in training, and Bridget, who's a big old St. Bernard. And also the wise dogs also have, like, a trio of Dobermans who act as their guard dogs.
Yeah.
Which is, like, go in and scout places out. And I kind of like them because they're just dogs. They don't have magic or anything. So, like, there's bits where they're, like, running around casting all their magic spells. And then you see just kind of one of the guards just kind of, like, hanging off a troll.
Yep. It's bizarre just how enjoyable Beasts of Burden is.
It is.
If you just put the idea down on paper and you say, okay, there's a group of dogs who can do magic who are secretly protecting the world from the forces of evil magicians who are human, for the most part.
It's something. It sounds like it'd be kind of like a slightly goofy book, but it's not. It's a concept they play entirely seriously.
Yeah.
And actually make work.
Yeah. And the horror is great in it as well, isn't it?
Yeah, like, it's a genuinely, like, quite unsettling, dark horror story as well. Because, I mean, this one ends up being, like, proper Lovecraftian. We're going to summon the old gods from beneath the mountains.
Yeah.
Like, it's a bunch of flavours that you think shouldn't go together, but do. And I think a lot of that is Benjamin Dewey's art, which is just lovely picture book art.
Yeah.
Like, it's picturesque when it needs to be. It's creepy when it needs to be. He does such a good job of making the dogs, like, actually look like and feel like realistic dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Beasts of Burden. As per usual, cannot recommend highly enough.
I love the title, Wise Dogs and Eldritch Men, the play on Mad Dogs and Englishmen.
Ah, I didn't even catch that. Listen.
Is this the second time in one show when I've stopped Andrew in his tracks?
I never at any point said I was smart. That's why I host a podcast about comic books.
Yes.
All right, Mick, Country Roads, take us home.
Cloak and Dagger, Negative Exposure. From Marvel's first time in print series of, well, let's try printing this as a graphic novel because it seemed to work as a web comic.
The thing that's, I don't get it.
So this is Cloak and Dagger, and I think one thing I have noticed with these, I did one a few weeks back that was Daughter of the Dragon, they do seem to be spinning these out from the Marvel TV shows.
Yeah.
And focusing on them. And I've got to be honest, I found that this Cloak and Dagger edition carries the same problem as the TV show. It's not a comic book hero TV show. It's not a comic book hero comic. It's about relationships.
Ah, no, not relationships.
It's basically Marvel Superheroes 90210.
Yeah, they kind of angsty teen drama type thing.
Yeah, you've got about 80% of the comic is about Tyrone and Tandy bitching at each other after they split up. There's clearly been some other comic-based stuff going on, and they've split up and they're not working together. She's dating a cop. He starts dating this woman who just turns up randomly, seemingly only to be a plot device to make Tandy jealous. Through the course of the story, there's a bit of development of Tyrone as Cloak. He starts to engage with the Dark Force more closely and discovers that it's not just a void that he falls through when he's shifting between A and B. There's actually a whole sort of universe in that dimension that he starts interacting with. And then there is a plot line involving Mr. Negative, who isn't just a man, by the way, for those of you unfamiliar, who goes around going, "That's rubbish."
Is he a MasterChef judge?
I thought the Negative Man was just somebody who's like, "Well, look, just don't involve me. Nobody likes me anyway." That sort of negative.
Yeah. That's rubbish, that is.
Yeah, I can't wait for the sequel where Cloak and Dagger have to fight the rest of the Mr. Men.
Mr. Negative.
Oh, God. So, Mr. Tickle versus Cloak.
But Mr. Negative seems to be there just as a cipher to show Tandy and Tyrone just how much they really do miss each other and how they work well together as a team. I mean, there is a brief sort of 10-page bit where he brings the Devourer through into this dimension, but that's over in like a sneeze.
Who's the Devourer?
It's a big eye. It's basically Marvel's version of Sauron.
It's a generic evil end of the world monster.
It's a combination of a big eye and tentacles.
Why do they always have? Why is it always like a gigantic eye with tentacles?
Because creativity is hard. Also, I would actually read a series about Mr. Negative working as like a really unorthodox relationship counsellor.
Oh my God. No, they already did the movie. It was called Hitch and it starred Will Smith.
That's right. That was my favourite bit of Hitch, where Will Smith was all, "Yo, I know how you're going to let this girl know how you feel while I summon the Elder Gods." I think he even did a rap about it at the end.
It's called Boom, Shake, Shake, Shake the Room.
But yeah, so, you know, I think there's an audience for this. I just don't think I'm it, because I'm not 14 and dating.
Or suffering from angst.
And it's kind of what I feel about the series as well. Pretty much every episode I've seen of Cloak and Dagger, it's mainly consumed with them bitching at each other about their backgrounds and whether they're going to be heroes and villains and stuff like that. And it's tedious.
Oh, that is my least favourite thing in superhero TV shows, is any character saying, "I don't know if I'm going to be a hero." Yes, you are. Yes, you are going to be a hero. That's literally the whole point.
Because that's why you're popular enough as a comic for them to have made a TV show out of you.
Yep.
Yeah, like, I sure loved that one series of Green Arrow when he decided, "Nash, I can't be faffed with being Green Arrow." And then Malcolm Merlyn blew up the city and everyone died at the end.
Yeah. And that bit in Gotham where Bruce Wayne decided that after 5 years he was just going to dress in really bright clothes and live happily ever after.
He was going to turn that frown upside down.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be the most perfect end to Gotham. If the final scene was Bruce Wayne opening up the Batcave, pulling out the iconic Batman mask, looking at it for like a single beating. Nah. Be the greatest practical joke in all of human history.
And now I want someone to do it.
Yeah. So yeah, the artwork's okay. There's nothing particularly awful about it. It's just a bit wet, really. I mean, the best character in it is Vi. She's a bit lively. But then is cast aside the minute she's served her purpose, which is to make Tandy jealous.
Boo. Bad comic.
Yeah.
Gonna roll up a newspaper and bonk you on the nose with it.
Yeah. So that's me done.
Well, that's...
That's us done in general, as a show.
It is indeed.
Yeah. If you want to catch up with any of our previous episodes, you'll find them all on our website or on Audioboom or Apple Podcasts. And if you're listening through anything like a podcast aggregator of some sort, then leave us a rating, leave us a review. It does help us with exposure. Also on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk, you'll find our Patreon, our shop, and various other things that we are involved in as well.
I thought you were going to burst into song there.
Yeah, maybe I was.
I was praying you weren't.
I've been Andrew.
I've been Mick.
And I've been Rob. We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye now.
You threw me completely with that.
Then my work here is done.